Okay, so going through the study guide on page 3, Pratigya 1.1. The solemn statement of this chapter, entitled The First Step in God Realization, is directly given by Srila Prabhupada in his purport to the invocation Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This first chapter describes the glories of chanting, and it hints at the process by which the neophyte devotees may perform meditation on the universal form of the Lord. Right? So, in other words, chanting is the main process, like that. But this other aspect of meditation on the universal form, that is for, says the neophyte, in other words, it's for dealing with material desire, material conception. Right? So that's the whole idea of it. So one always wants to see that proportion. See, it's very important that just because what is less doesn't mean, means in volume, doesn't mean it's less in importance. Right? Does that make sense? That even though the chanting is, you know, maybe only a portion of our day, and the elements of the universal form may be greater, that doesn't mean that it, the greater volume is actually more important. The importance is chanting. Right? That's the main point, is that someone who's chanting 24 hours a day, that's perfection of engagement. But because of the conditioned nature, we are distracted by other things. So that distraction then doesn't make it more important. You know what I'm saying? Because we're distracted, that doesn't make that more important than what we're supposed to be doing. But that we're distracted means you have to take care of that distraction. Does that make sense? So that's the idea. But this must be dealt with very maturely, otherwise then one does not want to increase the distraction. Or say that the distraction is just as important. Right? No, it's less important. But it does have to be dealt with. Right? You have service, you also have a cold. So the cold is a distraction to your service. You take care of the cold. Because you're taking care of the cold, you don't say, oh, now the cold is more important, and all you do is take care of the cold and give up the service. Does that make sense? No. You're giving up means what time or energy must be put into getting rid of the cold is given, not more, not less. Right? It means it's not ignored, otherwise then the service might be affected more later. Right? But at the same time, as if it, how much you need to give, only that much is given. Does that make sense? So that's what one's trying to do. Does that make sense? So the proportion then is being given is that the holy name is the most important, but elements of distraction that are there in our in because of our conditioned nature, they must be dealt with, but only in support of chanting. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. 1.1.1. In the same purport, Srila Prabhupada compares the aims of first and second cantos, and briefly but most memorably summarizes the aim of the 10 chapters of Canto 2 as a whole. In the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the principles of creation are described, and thus the first canto may be called creation. It says here, principles, right? Because principles are actually more important than the details. Second canto gives the details, but the first canto gives the principles, so that shows what is more important, right? Similarly, in the second canto, the post-creation causing manifestation is described. The different planetary systems described in the second canto as different parts of the universal body of the Lord. For this reason, the second canto may be called the cosmic manifestation. There are 10 chapters in the second canto, and in these 10 chapters, the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam and the different symptoms of this purpose are narrated. So in other words, connecting everything to the Lord is there. Right? So I say that's actually our purpose. And then it says symptoms means ways you can tell or ways that you can do this connection. Does that make sense? Right? That's what one's trying to do. So now we've pointed out that chanting is the most important. And then the purpose means that you're going to, through this process, connect everything to the Lord, right? Whether it means emphasis on the chanting, if you can do it mainly through that, that's best. If not, then it's supported by the elements of understanding the universal form. So that in this way, then, between the two, you're going to get yourself to the point where you're always going to be absorbed in the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? Right? So that's what the whole canto is doing. But in this chapter specifically, it's bringing out the glories of the chanting, because you're always going to start with what's most important first. Then from there, you're going to go into what's secondary. Right? Does that make sense? 112. Again, the above two quotations of Srila Prabhupada are from his purport to the invocation of Canto 2, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. The holy name Vasudeva is most significant here, both in terms of this particular chapter and the entire canto. Okay, then 1121. Chapter 1 describes the glories of chanting, and it hints at the process by which the devotees may perform meditation on the universal form of the Lord. So then in pursuance of that, on the glories of chanting, Sri Vishnu Sahasranam Stotra, text 133, as commented upon by Acharya Baladeva Vidyabhushan, states that chanting the Lord's many holy names purifies the devotee easily, establishing him in Vasudeva Sattva. The devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna, who perform the pious activities of chanting these 1,000 holy names of the Lord, become free from anger, envy, greed, and all wicked thoughts within the mind. Nimisha 1. Compare this to Srila Prabhupada's statements in Bhagavatam 2.1.2.4 about Griyamedis. See also his prescription in verse 5 for gaining freedom from the anarthas that plague such envious people. Right? Does that make sense? So this is where then when you're studying, you go back and compare the two. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Yeah? Okay, it means, in other words, the point's being made here. And this is from Baladeva Vidyabhushan. So you see in Prabhupada's purports, 2 to 4 and 5, then he is also commenting on the same. So then you can see the connection and all that, right? That brings that element out. That's most important. So it's by chanting that all bad things will go from the heart, right? That's how they're going to go. But those that we specifically are attached to or focus on, then we can bring, we deal with them by connecting them to Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? I mean, it's like taking a bath, all dirt goes away, but if you happen to have a spot that's more dirty, then you may concentrate on that and scrub that. Right? But the point is the bath is what takes everything away. Right? So scrubbing is just part of that. So the chanting is what frees one from all bad things. And these other elements then are supportive of that. Right? 112.12. Concerning meditation upon the universal form, the next text of Sri Vishnu Sahasranam states, the entire expanse of outer space, along with the sun, moon, stars, and planets, the ether, the directions, the earth, planet, and the great oceans, are all maintained by the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vasudeva. So that means everything in the creation is maintained by him. But all these various elements, then they also are representing so many other things, right? Because the outer space means that's what's between earth and heaven. So that includes all the Gandharva, Rakshasas, Yakshas, the Paisachas, anything that's not demigods, right? The demons, everybody like that. So you have the earth planet, what's below the earth planet. That and what's in between the earth planet and the heavenly planets, that's all counted as Bhuvar, right? That's the outer space. Right? Swa is, so he says earth, right? The earth planet, okay, the outer space. So this is Bhur, you get Bhur Bhuva Swa, right? Does that make sense? So you have earth, you have heaven, then anything that's in between. It doesn't need to be physically in between, it means that the position of the residence is in between. Right? They have special potencies, special powers. Right? Rakshasas are more powerful than human beings. So they're in between humans and demigods. just they happen to be a little bit more rough, that's all. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So all these then have their position. Sun has its influence, moon has its influence, stars, planets, right? Our whole life is on the material platform is ruled by these. Right? I mean, so much that is there, all these different personalities, they're the ones that manage our lives day to day, right? Putting us into the various situations that are there, right? Does that make sense? So they do all this. So he's saying that that is maintained by the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It means it's his potency that makes them work. So that, therefore, you could see Krishna in it. Either you can see that science as a Vedic science, and therefore this Vedic science is, technically what's managing everything. But behind that, actually, is the Supreme Lord. Right? Does that make sense? That's why you could either consider, like discussion the other day on this, was there on astrology and astronomy and all those things. So you could either consider those things or not. Right? In other words, if the more you're considering the Lord, the less you have to consider those. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is your consciousness is filled with everything around you. So either you're aware of what's around you, you're conscious of it, or you're conscious more directly of the Supreme Lord. But conscious you must become. Right? To be unconscious, that you don't see God's hand in everything, and you don't see actually mechanically how the universe is working, that's ignorance. Right? That's unacceptable. Right? So someone who by nature is attached to astrology or astronomy, then they're going to see that element that's there. And then they should be trying to see how Krishna is behind that. Does that make sense? Someone who's not attached to that would just see Krishna. Right? They'll be attached to something else. They'll be attached to their family. So therefore, they're going to have to see Krishna in the potencies that are making up the family. Or they're not necessarily there, but you know, the particular other occupation they have. They may be into medicine, they may be into so many things, right? Like you can see someone is, they're a family person, but you know, medicine is more important to them. So everything is all about health, and eating this is about health, eating that's about health. No one in the family can enjoy eating anything because, you know, it's healthy. You know, like that. Either tastes healthy, or even though it tastes nice, you know, you get disrupted by a lecture of how healthy it is. So therefore, you know what I'm saying? So it takes prominence. So that's why then it's connected to the Ayurveda, which is connected to the Lord, or the principles Krishna says he is the healing herb, you know, like this. So then you understand that potency is Krishna. So that's why it's special. You know what I'm saying? But each individual is going to have what they are specifically attached to. Does that make sense? So that's why they may be attached to those things that connect them, but with time, then that's all cleared away and it just gives way to Krishna's potencies, which means to Krishna, which means to Krishna and his devotees. Does that make sense? Right? The potency means you understand the Brahman aspect of the Lord. Right? You know it's a person, but you're studying the Brahman aspect because you're attached to that Brahman. Right? You're attached to the material Brahman. Right? Which means the material energy. Right? Material energy is Brahman. Brahman means Krishna. Whatever's come from Krishna and whatever's come from Krishna is all Brahman. Right? But there's superior, inferior Brahman. So material energy is also Brahman. Right? But that we see it as something important for us without connection to Krishna, that's called Maya. Right? We see it in connection to Krishna, then it's Brahman, but it's inferior Brahman. But it's still Brahman. Right? So the idea is that you're meditating upon, your attachment is to this Brahman, so you meditate on it in connection to Krishna. It's Krishna's Brahman. So that's Brahman realization. Right? Then with time you see that it's the person behind it, it's his energies. That's Paramatma. Right? Then you see Krishna and his pastimes with his devotees. That's Bhagavan. Right? Does that make sense? So we know it's the person, but we're realizing the person in these stages. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I always thought that this meditation on universal form is something very mystic experience that you're seeing so many heads. Like
you are seeing so many heads. This room is full of heads.
Yeah, but like Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, so this picture is.
If you're into mysticism, then one might think like that. You know, if that's one's attachment, then that might be there. But the point is, you know, to get an experience, you don't need thousands of heads. One head's enough. You know what I'm saying? Like that. You know what I'm saying? It means understanding, like, how your arm works. That's dealing with the universal form. What makes your arm work, right? 1/10,000th the tip of the hair is picking up something millions of times bigger than them, right? Is that how it works? Right? An ant can pick up, what, 6 times? I think there's a beetle that can pick up 40 times. You know, strongest living entity in the universe, this little beetle this big, right? Right? Whatever. You know what I'm saying? So how is something picking up, you know, millions and millions of times bigger? Right? Probably billions of times bigger, right? It's the Lord's potency. So the Lord is doing that. He is movement, right? He has arms, therefore our arms work. He has eyes and sees, therefore we can see. He has a nose and smells, therefore we can smell. You know what I'm saying? Universal form is doing all the smelling, touching. You just happen to be, you know, passing by, right? You may be passing by for 100 years in this body, but still you're passing by. So you happen to then identify with this particular, you know, set of senses, this particular head, you know, like that. And so then you think that this is you, but it's actually part of the universal form. Your head is part of the universal form, right? Like that. These senses are his senses, not ours. You know what I'm saying? The potency behind them that makes them work is him. Does that make sense?
That's more practical.
Everything is practical. Devotional life is practical. Mystic means you just want to get some buzz out of it. Right? But even that buzz has to work. You don't get the buzz, you don't bother. Right? You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. Is the living entity is looking for an experience. Right? Experience is good, they continue. Experience is not good, then they stop. Right? Does that make sense? So the whole point is, but to get that experience means you have to make arrangements, right? Even you like to experience nature, you still have to get in the car and drive down to where there is some nature, and then get out of the car, and then get out, stretch your arms, and breathe the crisp air, and then go, ah, so nice, right? You know, so then you still have to make the endeavor. You know, so if you get in your car, drive to the center of downtown where the flea market is, and then get out and stretch your arms, and then you might not get the same experience, right? So it's not practical. Right? Practical means you get it. Right? So devotional life is the most practical lifestyle. Right? Because it works. It gets what you're looking for. Anything else is not practical. It doesn't actually get what you're looking for. Does that make sense? You know, the guys dress up, you know, they're half falling off pants and weirdo this and that, and then they go out and, you know, their idea is that's really going to, you know, impress the girls, right? The girls think it's one of the most stupid things that ever came along, right? You ever see married people dressed like that? No, right? Why? Because women don't want their men looking like idiots, right? But that's like when you go to the market, right? You just deal what's there. You know what I'm saying? It's just a pile of potatoes. So you kind of pick through the pile and, you know, whatever's the best one there, you take that. Right? You know what I'm saying? So amongst all the idiots out on the street, then the girls pick through that and then pick out one that they think they can do something with. Then take it home and then clean it up and dress it up. You understand? Right? So, therefore, the idea that the modern person does is not actually practical. You know what I'm saying? Because it doesn't really work. What's working is that they're putting themselves in contact with females, and then by the modes of nature, hopefully something happens and one decides that they're, you know, the potato worth taking home. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? But the idea that you put on these various clothes, you stand around cutting your profile, looking cool, that's not actually. That you're making the endeavor, that's what impresses the girls. You're trying to look cool, you're trying to look this. You look like an idiot, but you're trying to look cool. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's what's going on. Right? So it's not very practical. So the Vedic is the boys dress up nicely, you know, like that, you know, the way that they would be still dressed up once they're, you know, they're married. And so then, in this way, then it's direct. Why waste your time on the other things, right? Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, then, yeah. Okay, so in other words, everything that influences our life is maintained by Krishna, right? So the main meditation is on Krishna. So if you're thinking of Krishna, you don't have to worry about everything else. But if there's anything within Krishna's creation that somehow or another is overly attractive or a great attachment for you, then you see it in connection with Krishna because he's the one maintaining it anyway, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. 1, 1, 2, 2. In pure devotional service, Srila Prabhupada explains the holy name Vasudeva in Bhagavatam 4.3.23 purport. In pure devotional service, one simply serves the Supreme Personality of Godhead as a matter of duty, without reason and without being impeded by material conditions. This is called Shuddhasattva or Vasudeva, because in that stage, the Supreme Person, Krishna, is revealed in the heart of the devotee. Srila Jiva Goswami is very nicely described as Vasudeva or Shuddhasattva. In his Bhagavad Sandarbha, he explains that Ashtotara Sata, 108, is added to the name of the spiritual master to indicate one who is situated in Shuddhasattva, or in the transcendental state of Vasudeva. The word Vasudeva is also used for other purposes. For example, Vasudeva also means one who is everywhere or all-pervading. God. The sun is also called Vasudeva Shabditam. The word Vasudeva may be utilized for different purposes, but whatever purpose we adopt, Vasudeva means the all-pervading or localized Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita 7.19, it is also stated, Vasudeva Sarvam Iti. Factual realization is to understand Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and surrender unto Him. Vasudeva is the ground wherein Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is revealed. Right? So in other words, the Vasudeva platform of Vasudeva is where the Supreme Lord Vasudeva is revealed. So the relevance in the connection here is Vasudeva is who is maintaining and who is pervaded everywhere. We see in the last one also, Vasudevasya Virena, that the Lord is maintaining everything. Right? And then here, then he brings out this element, Vasudeva Sarvamiti. So he is everything, he is everything, everywhere. So that state of always being here, as a matter, one serves, simply serves as a matter of duty without reason, without being impeded. Matter of duty means this is what you're supposed to do because this is your natural relationship. This is what activities are performed. Without reason means you don't have a purpose yourself. I'm not doing this because then I'll get some benefit from it, some monetary, some facility, some position, some prestige, some recognition. I'm not doing it because of that. And without being impeded by material conditions, no matter what the conditions are, that devotional mood still remains. Right? It doesn't mean that impediments don't come up. It means you're not impeded by them. Does that make sense? Devotion is not disturbed by them. Right? Does that make sense? So it's expected that impediments will be there. Sometimes we think, oh, why are there so many impediments? I'm serving Krishna. But that's actually where things become interesting, right? Mahabharata, okay, let's say, here's here, let's let us readjust the Mahabharata, right? The Pandavas then, how you say, their father is living in the kingdom. Then they are born to their father, no need of demigods because he wasn't cursed. And, you know, he was the senior brother, so therefore, because his elder brother is blind, so he sits on the throne. And then when he gets older, then he retires to the forest and makes Yudhishthira the king, who's supported by all his sons. They go around, all the kings of the world surrender to them. They perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. They are the emperors of the world. And then, you know, like this, they rule the kingdom at the end of life. Then they turn the kingdom over to Parikshit Maharaj and that. And but his name's not Parikshit Maharaj because he wasn't burnt in the womb, so therefore he's not looking for that person who saved him. You know, so, you know, then like that, then they went to the forest and went back to Godhead. Great book, huh? Gonna read it again, right? No. Right? Isn't it? No. So that's the whole point, is that it's the impediments and the determination and the intelligence and that commitment of the person, despite all these things, that makes it interesting. Does that make sense? It's all part of that we were discussing yesterday, that pattern of the energy going up and down. When it's good, then it's got to go bad. When it's just the way it works. You know? It's just the pattern that the sooner you get used to it, the easier life is. Right? So, the whole idea is that it's all connected, so therefore it works. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So, when we come to that state, in that state, then that's when you're going to realize Krishna very dynamically. Right? Any state, there's some understanding, otherwise why is anybody here? Something is there. But, this state is where it becomes very dynamic, right? And Vasudeva here is—he's the one. He is the former Lord performing the pastimes, right? He is the one who's actually doing all the different things. So then, in that state, then is what's making it work. So in the material world, also Paramatma has entered into everything. He's what makes the whole thing work, right? But the ultimate goal is Krishna, right? Bhagavan form. So that's where we're trying to get to, right? So when you get to that platform, then Krishna is the one who's making everything work. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Until that time, then Paramatma is making everything work. Because he's there, he'll go everywhere, he'll be involved with everything. Krishna doesn't do that, he doesn't leave Vrindavan. So when we come to that platform where we realize Krishna in Vrindavan, then it all starts to work. Yeah? That makes sense. Okay. Then we have 1, 1, 2, 3. Srila Raghava Goswami compares Lord Vasudeva and other Vishnu Tattva forms. These verses taken from Hari Bhakti Ratna Prakash would be a great use to your study of later portions of this canto. So there's a run of verses here. The most perfect form is Bhagavan Krishna Chandra, who remains in Vrindavan. All other forms of the Lord are not as perfect. The more perfect forms are Lord Balaram and Lord Vasudeva, who reigns as king of Dwarka. The perfect forms include the Lord Prajumna, Lord Aniruddha, and other forms of the Lord. Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, Lord Shiva, Lord Mahavishnu, and others are all counted in the perfect category. Akura traveled to Mathura with the Vasudeva feature of Lord Vishnu. When the Lord was going to Mathura, Akura saw him as Lord Vasudeva reclining on the lap of thousand-headed Ananta. And then quoting from the Bhagavatam, on the curved lap of Seshanag, Akura saw Krishna sitting very soberly. With four hands, his eyes were like the reddish petals of the lotus flower. His complexion was the dark color of a rain cloud, and he was dressed in yellow silken garments. In the same way, the Lord appeared in Dwarka in his Vasudeva form. This may be known from the following passage of Srimad Bhagavatam 10:60-44, where Rukmini Devi says to Lord Vasudeva, O my Lord, O subduer of enemies, as an unfortunate woman who has never heard of your glories may accept an ordinary man as her husband, But a woman who has learned about you, that you are praised not only in this world, but in the halls of the great demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, will not accept anyone besides yourself as her husband. We may note that although Srimati Rukmini Devi does not mention Lord Vasudeva by name, it is clear from a description of the Lord that she refers to the Vasudeva expansion of Lord Vishnu. The qualities of Lord Vishnu are described in the following statement of Brihad Naradiya Purana. Lord Brahma is known as Swayambhu because he is the first living entity to appear in the universe. Lord Shiva is known as Hara because he destroys the material universe. Lord Vishnu is known by his name because he is the master of all powers and all potencies. Right? So that means Vasudeva, means all powers, all pervading, who is everywhere, who is running everything. So that's Vasudeva. After he had gone to Mathura in order to kill Kamsa, the Lord manifested the power and opulence of the Vishnu Vasudeva form. This is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.43.17 in the following words, which describe Lord Vasudeva's opulence of appearing differently to different living entities. Within Kamsa's wrestling area, the Lord appeared to the wrestlers exactly like a thunderbolt. To the people in general, he appeared as the most beautiful personality. To the females, he appeared to be the most attractive male, Cupid personified. The Lord also exhibited the character of Lord Vasudeva in other situations. One example is how he expanded into 16,000 forms to enjoy transcendental pastimes in the different homes of his 16,000 wives in Dwarka, as was observed by Mahamuni Narada. Another example is the Lord's revelation of his universal form to Arjuna. The Lord also exhibited a four-armed form during the great battles fought after his kidnapping Rukmini and after his taking the Parijata tree of Indra. At various other times also, the Lord of Dwarka rode on Garuda and also exhibited a four-armed form holding conch, disc, club, and lotus. This feature of Lord Vasudeva is also described by Lord Shiva in the following words, Srimad Bhagavatam 4.24.28. Lord Shiva continued, "Any person who is surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, the controller of everything, material nature as well as the living entity, is actually very dear to me." So, yeah, he points out here is that this shows that this demonstrates, Vasudeva. So it's because you're dealing here material nature as well as the living entity, right? That means you've actually understood Vasudeva. Vasudeva doesn't just mean Krishna expanded everywhere. The Krishna expanded everywhere means his potency. So that also means the material energy. It means all the living entities. It means the devotees. It means everything. So that means that's Vasudeva, right? Not just Krishna. As a person means everything's connected to him. Does that make sense? This evidence clearly demonstrates that the Lord's form in Mathura and Dwarka is the expansion of Lord Vasudeva. The form of Sri Krishna Chandra is the ultimate form of the Lord and is superior to his form as Vishnu Vasudeva. Vishnu Vasudeva is the master of Vaikuntha Loka, right? Because here Vasudeva can also mean Krishna, right? But here, so that's why he's saying Vishnu Vasudeva, just like we'll say Braja Krishna. Because Krishna can also be a Vasudeva form or a Vishnu form. Does that make sense? So by saying Vishnu Vasudeva, then specifically we're meaning where Krishna is entering everything and expanding like this. Right? Does that make sense? Or if we say Braja Krishna, here he uses Krishna Chandra. That means what we would call Braja Krishna. Right? So they make some distinctions so it's very clear which form. Vishnu Vasudeva is the master of Vaikuntha Loka. From him, Lord Mahavishnu is expanded. To prove that the Lord's form at Dwarka is Vishnu Vasudeva, the following evidence is quoted. When Jaya Vijaya were cursed by the Brahmanas at the gateway of Vaikuntha Loka, the Supreme Personality of Godhead spoke to them the following words. If you both agree to become my enemies, I shall liberate you after three births. For this reason, Jaya and Vijaya were born as Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, whom Lord Vishnu killed in his forms of Varaha and Nrsimha. In the next yuga, Jaya and Vijaya were born as Ravana and Kumbhakarna, who were killed by Lord Vishnu in his forms as Ramachandra and Lakshmana. After that, Jaya and Vijaya were born as Shishupal and Dantavakra, and Lord Vishnu appeared as Lord Vasudeva and Lord Balaram and again killed them. In this way, Jayan Vijay attained liberation after three births. Sri Krishna Chandra's power and opulence is superior to that of Lord Vishnu and that of any other person. This is confirmed by the following statement of Narada Pancharatra. Right, so what he's saying is he's proving this is that Dwarka Krishna is there because Krishna and Balaram killed Shishupal and Dantavakra, and Vishnu of Vaikuntha, right, Vishnu Vasudeva said, that's what I'll do. Right, so therefore he's connecting that, therefore that proves that Krishna and Dwarka is Vasudeva Krishna. Right, that makes sense, logic. Okay. Narada Pancharatra. The forms of Lord Ramachandra and the other incarnations of Godhead all spring from Sri Krishna, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. From this we may understand that all Vishnu forms and other forms of the Personality of Godhead are expanded from Sri Krishna Chandra. Right, which also here can take it very much more stronger, is Narada Pancharatra is a conversation between Narad Muni and Lord Shiva. Right? So that means Lord Shiva is either saying this verse itself or he's listening to this verse. So, right? So the two of them are discussing how Krishna is the supreme form, right? So that will take out that anybody else is. Sri Krishna Chandra, the supreme personality of Godhead, stays in Divya Vrindavan. It is described in the Goloka Samhita. The transcendental realm of Vrindavan is situated within the Brahman effulgence. In that transcendental Vrindavan are Radhika Devi, whom all the Lord's potencies respectfully worship, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, the crest jewel of all deities. The Bhagavatam verse commentary of 1123 is from Hari Bhakti Ratna Prakash, 5th Ray. The Goloka Samhita. Right? So here it's also another, they call it Divya Vrindavan, right? Like that. So that will then separate it from the Boma Vrindavan. Right? Okay, any questions on this up to now? Yes.
Maharaj, there is the explanation that God Vrindavan is divided in three, Vrindavan, Mathura and Dwaraka. So what are the differences between Mathura and Dwaraka and then Vaikuntha planets?
Mathura is in between, because there you're having Mahanarayan. Is there, from him is expanding Vasudev, Shankar, Shankar, Jumna, Nadiruddha. Right, so Mahanarayan, it's Krishna and Balaram, so that intimacy, that closeness is there. But, so there's a little bit more sweetness, a little bit more intimacy. It's not as quite as formal as Dwarka. Like that. So it's a little bit closer. Like that. You see the, yeah, does that make sense? There's a little bit more variety of pastimes. It means rasa's there. It means the manifestation of them in the way of their intimacy. Right? But then we see then Dwarka. So Dwarka technically is Vaikuntha. Right? It means Mathura would also be Vaikuntha. That's where it begins. But just there you're manifesting all five rasas. When you get to what we would, you know, generally call Vaikuntha, then basically you're only manifesting servitorship. There's also would be Shanta Ras, so those two would be prominent. Lakshmi Devi is there, but it's not a prominent rasa. So conjugal rasa doesn't really feature. You know, he has his consort, so it's there, but it's not something that anybody else is really very much part of. Right? Not like in Dwarka or Mathura. Right? Mathura, you see Krishna comes and all the, you know, girls and ladies are up on the roof, you know, and they're all appreciating his beauty, like that. So that's all happening in Mathura, like that. Or in Dwarka, 16,108 queens, they have all their maidservants, like that. So a lot of the conjugal rasas manifest, right? But in Vaikuntha, then it's not as prominent, right? Servitorship is there, so then even Lakshmi Devi there is you know, the best servant. Right, everybody's assisting her in her service, you know, so the principles are the same, but this that element comes out more prominent than the actual interaction between the two of them. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yes, ma'am.
5b it says that Lord Shiva.
5b.
Yeah.
76b. 5b, okay.
That says that Lord Shiva is known as Hara because he destroys the material world. And this Mahamantra is Hare. So is it somehow
connected? No. Okay, so your name's Dixit, and if I go to India, there's a lot of other Dixits, so there's a direct connection between you and all of them. But the name is similar. Ben? Like that. Nice try. Nice try. Smarties are gonna make their move. You know? I think it's actually Shiva, you know. Shiva Krishna, Shiva. Okay, I can relate to that. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good try.
Maharaj, could you kindly a little elaborate what is the purpose of the other descriptions of the universe, like in fifth canto and I can't remember, eighth? How they are connected to this second canto? It seems to be.
Because whenever, how are all the other descriptions of the cosmic manifestation connected with the second canto?
Yeah.
Because whenever you start a new discussion, you always have to connect everything back to its origin, right? So most things when you're dealing in the material world, you just have to take back to the primary creation. You know, like the Pancharatra will take it all the way back to Vaikuntha or even back to Goloka. Does that make sense? So that's just how it works. It starts from there and comes out. That's why, even though it's such an obvious principle, it shows the lack of, you know, how you say, really broad intelligence or mature intelligence of the modern academics, that they can't understand why would creation be always in the beginning of every literature. So they take it as an interpolation. If you're really smart, you'd probably say, why is it every Vedic literature does that? So maybe there's a pattern here. Right? Because the ability to see patterns is, you know, one of the main functions of intelligence. Right? But, you know, even their own scripture, because they're based on modern academies, actually based on, you know, the Christian, you know, how you say, background. That's where modern academics started. So even their book starts with creation, but somehow or another, they don't call that an interpolation. I guess maybe because they only have, you know, 1 1/4 pages, or one and I think it's about 1 1/3 pages on creation. And the Vedic literatures sometimes they'll have 10, 20, 50 pages, therefore, you know, it must be made up. You know. So it's a very strange concept. But that's because you're always starting there because that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with material energy. So you in the material sphere should be able to see Krishna in that environment. You know what I'm saying? And in this way, then you connect things across. It means if you just go in the kitchen, I'm cooking for Krishna, and you just are just meditating, how to nicely cook for Krishna, then there's no problem, right? The problem is that you're in the kitchen cooking for Krishna, and you're, you know, thinking about something else, you know, about your wife or family or money or, you know, something like that. So then that's where then the element of the universal form needs to come in to bring it up to, back up to the standard, because you're cooking and doing it for Krishna, so that's that direct connection. But the mind is distracted by things that aren't connected, so you must connect them. Right? So therefore, basically every shastra will have creation in it. Even Mahabharata has about half a page that it describes the creation. Right? And generally it is creation described in such a way that it connects to the subject matter you're dealing with. Right? It connects with the elements that you're dealing with. So depending upon what you're connecting, then the creation will be more or less complexly described, you know? So like Manu, because you're dealing with everything in the universe, basically, that's, you know, whatever there is on this planet and whatever has influence on this planet, you know, because they do respect demigods, they respect the antariksha, they respect, you know, the space and all those, the forefathers, you know, you're affected by the sun, moon and stars, so the directions, you know, because they do something, you sit facing, you do Achman facing the east, so all these things are there, you know, you're aware of, you know, Yamaraj, you're aware of Varuna, you're aware of all these different personalities, so that means whatever has been created is part of the human consciousness. So that means then the description of creation must be quite elaborate in dealing with Manu. Or in here, since we're talking about spiritual upliftment of trying to connect everything to Krishna and trying to dissolve all of our material consciousness, you know, which has gone into material energy in so many ways, therefore the Bhagavatam will give very elaborate descriptions of creation. Right? But let's say Mahabharata, because it's mainly on the culture, it will only give enough that connects the culture. So simply you have to show how the culture connects to Krishna, and that's all. Right? Does that make sense? So it's, when we show the connection, then it works. You know, then we can see, okay, here's the Krishna consciousness in it. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like that. Another thing is that Krishna, Radharani, she is connects by the grace. You get to serve Krishna through his potency. That means also then obstacles are being removed. Right? So that's the removal part that you're, you know, how you say, attracted by. Right? Destroying the obstacles in devotional service, Radharani will also do that. Right? But she's the original one. She was there before Shiva. Right? You know, so therefore, you know, that element is actually part of her potency. Like that. Okay. You know, Krishna is the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. So the destructive element, that is known as Shiva. Right? Because actually he's auspicious because you're destroying that which is an obstacle to devotional service. Otherwise, ordinary destruction is not auspicious. So why is Shiva, why is the person who gets rid of the things called Shiva or is auspicious, right? Because it actually is meaning removing the obstacles, right? Shiva is in charge of the false ego. So removal of the false ego means that destroys your material existence, right? Shiva destroys material existence, right? So the actual material existence is not all this matter that we see. The actual existence is our false identity with it. So by Sadashiva's grace, you can be freed from that false ego. That means you actually destroy material existence. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So you can move up from Rudra to Sadashiva. Sadashiva is also how do you say, Advaitacharya. Right? Means it's just Krishna or Vishnu in the mood of destroyer, because he is maintainer, destroyer, and creator. So creator, that's Hiranyagarbha, that becomes, expands as Brahma, right? Then maintainer is Vishnu, then he's always there, so various Vishnu forms, Mahavishnu to Garbhadaksha Vishnu to Giridaksha Vishnu. And then Sadashiva, then that expands as Rudra in this, or Shambhu in this world. Does that make sense? So there is an original connection. All is not lost. Yes.
Yes, Maharaj, I'm sorry to be a bit behind in my understanding, but page 6, Rukmini's words do.
Ah, yes.
He was, particularly, she says that someone who has heard about you will never accept anybody besides yourself as her husband. And here it also says that her description, it's clear from her description that she refers to the Vasudeva expansion of Lord Vishnu.
Mm-hmm.
What about the Krishna in Golok, I mean Krishna in Vrindavan with the gopis?
It's the same thing.
Same.
The gopis also say the same thing.
Is it the same Vasudeva?
No, it's not the same Vasudeva. It means the aspect of that he's performing pastimes. There, then you're dealing with Govinda. You have Madan Mohan, Govinda, and Gopinath. So Govinda is who performs the pastimes. Madan Mohan is the attractive element of Krishna. Gopinath is that aspect of that affection for Krishna, or attachment to Krishna. But Govinda is performing the pastimes. So Govinda would be expand as Vasudeva.
The Paramatma in our hearts.
Yeah, it's also Vasudeva. Yeah, but it's another expansion. It's in the same line, but it's not the same. It means any Vishnu Tattva is Krishna. It's just a difference in mood. What is the mood being manifest? You know what I'm saying? So it's a slightly different mood. Like Krishna means Balaram is Krishna. But there's a difference in that he's expanded from him. He also has the mood of servant. So he's the supreme personality of Godhead. He's also the supreme personality of servitor Godhead, right? So that's different because Krishna Vasudeva. I mean Krishna, he doesn't have the mood of servant. It means of his own. He serves devotees, but therefore he's only Vishai or enjoyer. He's not Ashray. That's why Balaram doesn't have to come, you know, as anybody else to understand what it means to be a devotee. But Krishna has to come as someone else, as Lord Chaitanya. He has to take on the mood of his devotee, because otherwise, as Krishna, he's only master, he's not servant. But Balaram is simultaneously master of, you know, the cosmic creation, but servant of Krishna. So he already knows what it means. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So like that, then there's just different moods, you know, like that. There's different, like, with Krishna, then you get Parakiya Rasa in separation, right? But Ramachandra, you get Swakiya in separation, right? But like Krishna and Dwarka, that Parakiya is not in separation, right? That's Sambhog. So, like that, it's just you're tasting different aspects of what could be tasted, right? In other words, there's so many ways you could put together and like, how do you say, interact in any situation and enjoy any situation. So we have to try it this way, then try it that way. But Krishna simultaneously tries them all in different forms, right? Therefore, depending upon what it is, he's like, what's the prominent element? Therefore, he gets a name, Vasudeva, Shankar, Shankar, Jumnadi, Ruda, like this. Is that okay?
Yes. But the part of Rukmini's words saying that anybody who has learned about Lord Krishna will not accept anybody else as a husband.
Yeah, yeah.
Is she also referring to individual souls?
Yeah.
Yes, that we accept him as the.
Yeah, it means anybody who's really understands Krishna, and they would be attracted to him, why would they accept anybody else? You know what I'm saying? It's like, here you have Satchitananda, you know, it's eternal, or you have mucus bile and air that's going to go away after some time. You know, it's kind of like that. But the point is, because we still identify with that mucus bile and air, therefore we marry one. Right? But if the attraction to Krishna is so great, one doesn't. You know? You understand? So that was, that Rukmini makes the point, the gopis make the point.
But not every woman can get Krishna as a husband, even if she's accessible.
16,100 days, not bad. Therefore, socially, then she may accept, you know. You know,
yes.
A bag of stool over here, but you know, say, sorry, boys. You know, but you know, that's it. It just makes it easier. You know what I'm saying? They want to do service to Krishna, but you know, everybody else thinking that they're ladies, therefore they interact with them like that. So therefore, if you have a guy there, then all the other ones leave you alone. So that makes life easier. you know, like that, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, I heard that when Srila Prabhupada was taking darshan of Tirupati Balaji, he said afterwards that Balaji is actually Gopal Krishna. So that came to our mind, and, or we had some discussion about it, that is it so that Srila Prabhupada is seeing always Lord as Gopal Krishna, whether he is in Vishnu form or not, or is it actually that this deed is particular Gopal Krishna?
That I know of, I think, I'm not sure if Balaji has only two arms. I can't remember.
He has
two or four. So that aspect then also makes it, you know, like Krishna, like what do you call it? Udupi Krishna also, I think, just has two arms. Like that. So that from that aspect you could say he's Gopal. But from the other aspect, it's the same person. It's just he's playing this pastime. You know what I'm saying? Krishna is playing this pastime. So he says Gopal. So then that aspect of Krishna is playing this pastime. Does that make sense? This is the same also. Gopal comes as Udupi Krishna. He's there, you know, with his, you know, he's got his, you know, the churning rod and his handful of butter like that. You know, so that makes sense? So you'll have both. You know, he's manifesting in one sense as Vishnu, but at the same time is because that's how the devotees are seeing him. So he manifests that way. Does that make sense?
I can understand that there is this Ashraya Vishai relationship between the Lord Vishnu Tattva and the Jiva Tattva, the living entity, but it's hard for me to understand that there's also similar relationship of Ashraya Vishnu between different Vishnu Tattvas who are like each other's expansion.
Why would that be difficult? Whoever you expand from, you're naturally servant of, right? Isn't it? You know, it's just like you have a man, and he has children. He has a daughter, and he has a son, right? So the son is also masculine, so he's going to have his wife and his family. He's going to be, you know, master of that. But at the same time, he is servant of his father. Right? Well, the girl is just his servant. She's servant of the father. She'll be servant of the husband, servant of the son. Does that make sense?
As being all Vishnu Tattvas, they seem to be on the same level, but from this description, it comes that they are.
They are, but they're not. It means mentality is there. It means like you have two very powerful persons, and they're equally powerful, but it's not that the move between them, one sees the other one as senior or something. That can also be there, isn't it? Does that make sense? You know, you have, yeah. Is it not? So that's the point, is that the Lord Himself expands. That's why Krishna in Vrindavan is unique of all. That's why Swayam Krishna is the origin of everything, because His mood, He's only Vishai. There's no Ashraya there. So to taste Ashraya, He has to come as Lord Chaitanya. There He takes the mood of the devotee, then He becomes Ashraya. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to anybody else? Yes, no? No one's saying. It's a good thing that you hear you go on blabbering all day and everyone's so polite, no one says anything. Okay. You had a question? Oh, okay.
I have one more question. Referring to something you said earlier. You said that practical means it works.
Yeah.
would like to ask you, in what ways arranged marriages, traditional arranged marriages, more
effective? How is that?
Than the modern way of having a boyfriend, girlfriend, and then getting married.
Okay.
You said something about it yesterday, but
no, it's very, it means the practicalness of it. It means there's a principle of it that must be obtained. So, it's like this. Basically, marriage means you have two consenting persons that have a common enough personality and they agree to work together that they're going to make a grihastha ashram work for their lifetime, right? And, you know, specifically for us, that means that you have common interests in which you can therefore engage in Krishna's service. And the idea is by engaging those in Krishna's service, you burn them up, right? Through the combination of knowledge and, you know, offering to Krishna. Yeah? So now, that means you have to actually know who you are and who the other person is. Right? Now, how thoughtful or contemplative are most teenagers? Right? How deep do they go into actually meditating who they are, what is actually their nature, you know, what is actually suitable for them? Right? How many are there? Right? It's not so common. They could do it, but the general tendency is they may not. Right? Okay. So right there you have a problem. Second thing is if you put two teenagers together, a boy and a girl, how much do they actually try to figure each other out, other than how strong they are and what the bra size is? You know what I'm saying? How much do they really try to figure out? You know, they smile, the other one smiles, so they get some buzz out of it, so they think it's great. Right? Here you have a boy living at his house, completely maintained by his family. You have a girl living at her house, maintained by her family. The boy and girl come together whenever they are in the mood. Not when they have to, when they're in the mood. And they don't have to pay any bills or make any plans or do anything responsible. They simply, you know, can go out to the movies, go sit in the park, go for a walk, you know, do whatever they like, go spend a little money. The guy's got a little cash his father gave him, he buys something for the girl. It looks pretty good, right? Every time they're together, it's nice, it's happy. So it means the girl, you know, all her bad hair days happen when she's at home. The boy never sees it. Right? And when the boy's out, you know, roughing it up with the boys, the girl never sees it. So when they come together, everything seems really great. So you have two personalities that don't actually contemplate who they each are. And they come together under situations where you can't really understand who the other person is. And then they're going to make a great, great arrangement. That's going to result in a perfect marriage. You understand? How can it? So then, here it is, it's supposed to be, but of course, arranged marriages is also working on that the parents also are contemplating themselves, know what is the nature of man and woman, and have understood what their son and daughter is. Right? Then, by the parents interacting with the other parents, because the parents and the kids aren't much different, they can understand what is the standard. Right? Just like, let us say, you're one of the ones in your tradition. Okay, let's say you go over to the other family's house, right? So as a woman, you're not going to go hang out in the living room. That's where the men go. You're going to go into the kitchen, right? And when you're in the kitchen chatting with the other ladies of the other family, you know, with the possibility of connection there, then, you know, in dealing, you're going to be dealing with the food and all that. And so then you're going to pick up the spoon, right? And in the back of the spoon, there's that little curve there where it meets the bowl. Right? And if there's any dirt there, you're never going to go back to that house again, right? Right? So that you know this family is not of a good standard. Right? Your Brahmins, they're not clean. So we'll look for another family. Because if they're not clean, the daughter's not going to be clean. Right? You'll talk to the mother, you'll see how she reacts. You know, the women of the family, how they deal. You know, you'll be able to see the girl, right? The boy is not going to see, the husband is not going to see. But you can get in there, and as a woman, you know how she thinks. You can, women can behave however they like and bewilder men very easily, but they can't bewilder the women. The women know exactly where she's at. Isn't it? Like that. So you know your daughter, you know your son, you know the girl, you know, so like that, then it's known. Then you can see if this actually matches, right? Then the charts are checked, and it also has a good compatibility there. Then at that time, it's either depending on how traditional and the families are, because the more traditional they are, and generally the more the consistency is in the nature, then they can either just arrange the marriage, and that's the first, at the marriage is the first time the boy and girl see each other, or it can be that, you know, that then, you know, they're shown pictures, and so are you comfortable with this, right? Because the girl wants to make sure the guy looks okay also, right? You know, like that. So then like that you can do it. So then you're actually seeing who they are. So even if you don't have that facility to do that, then at least from the girl's or boy's side, then through some offices they should find out who they are. Because any boy or girl, to impress somebody, can be nice. Now, how long do they have to be nice? 3 months, 6 months, like that, you know? And then, because once attachment's there, very hard to break it off. Once attachment's there, attachment means you've crossed over reason. Right? Attraction is there, you're still using your intelligence, right? You're attracted, you're looking at that and analyzing, and attraction is there, yeah, it looks good, but still intelligence is working. But once attachment is there, means you've crossed over intelligence. And so now you don't see. So even though it's obvious the girl is starting to see things that are really, she doesn't really like, and her friends are telling her, hey, bail out now, this is not going to be good, she's attached and she won't give it up. So then only when she's together, then they find out that now that the parents aren't paying the bills, they're paying the bills. They're not only meeting on the weekends or on the nighttime when they're both in good shape, but now they live with each other 24/7. Then they actually find out who each other is. And since they don't know who they are, they wouldn't have had an ability to understand who the other person is anyway. So even if they do use the modern thing and live together for a year, still, what do they know of each other? Because they don't know who they are, how you know who the other person is. You know what I'm saying? And if you base a relationship on, you know, what happens between the bed sheets, then, you know, hey, you know, anybody can do well there. But that doesn't mean that you can live together, have similar interests, you know, that your goals are the same or anything else. So in that way, that's why you see most marriages nowadays just don't work at all. And that's because we're saying 75% marriage don't work, because we're counting actual marriages. But if a boy and girl live together and, you know, they have intimate relationships, technically they're married according to Gandharva rite. So if we add those into it, then we might see that, you know, it's up into the 90s of the percentage of, you know, not working. You know what I'm saying? But generally that, just because of the, you know, Malecha kind of like outlook on things, they kind of finesse that part. You know? So those who are serious enough to actually commit to marriage, those may fall apart. They're not counting even de factos that people live together and never get married, and how many of those fall apart. You know what I'm saying? So therefore we can see very, very, not a very good system. But the point is, the system of arranged marriage is where, for the father, finding a boy that'll take care of the girl on the standard that he, you know, she's accustomed to and he would want, has to be very much there. And the standards and the mother knowing what a girl needs would be looking at those elements. That kind of parents, they can arrange one. But ones who are just looking at finances, or just, you know, they're Hindu enough to know they have to get their children married, but not Hindu enough to actually do it right, that kind of arranged marriage is useless. You know what I'm saying? So it's not the arranged marriage that's, you know, more practical. It's the arranged marriage done properly is more practical. Right? So it's either the arranged marriage is done properly or you do it properly yourself. But like this. This would be if you wanted to do it yourself, okay, the boy and girl don't have facility or they don't trust their parents, fine, whatever it is. But this would be like the first meeting between the boy and the girl, right? You know, it wouldn't be all the, you know, little touchy-feely and this and that and see how far you can get, you know, like that. Can you touch your hand? Can you, you know, get me like this? It would be, okay, you know, once pleasantries are exchanged and it's kind of like, I'm into, you know, I'm a devotee and so that's very important to me. So, you know, I'm at this level, you know, either I'm interested in full, you know, temple life or I'm interested in living outside, we want to work at this economic, you know, situation. Children, I'm into this many children, and that's it. I want to live this kind of lifestyle, like that. And so, how many couples do you know of on the first meeting? This is the discussion. They always think we'll talk that later. No, you don't talk that day. It's not going to work because if you can't open a dialogue that you can talk at that level, it's never going to work. So if you can't talk like that, it won't work. If you can't talk like that, you got a good shot. So if they want to do it themselves, okay, but do it right. But this thing just going and smiling and then getting it. So all it is basically how close you can get and how much you can get them under control. That's all. But they haven't discussed who they are and what they value. It may be discussed a little bit, but it's just in passing to get a little closer. You know what I'm saying? Get a little farther in. That's all. The boy, what he can touch. The girl, how much she can control. That's all. So they haven't really discussed who they are and what's their purpose. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but the modern girl might say, how can the parents know me?
Of course. They don't know themselves, so how anybody else would. So it's true. They don't know who they are. Otherwise, then, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? It's just like this. You are who you're going to be after marriage, so therefore that's how you should present yourself before marriage, right? The girl is very easy. She's very easily available. But after marriage, she doesn't deal like that. Right? You know what I'm saying? Before marriage, it's just very easy. After marriage, it's why do you only care for my body? But that's exactly the method she used to attract the boy. So that's, as far as the boy knows, that's who she is. So she doesn't know herself, because if that's what she wanted, why would she present that and catch a boy who only would think that? She would behave in a way if she wants to be dealt with as a respectable person who's respected as an individual. Right? That, why would she behave as one and find somebody like that? Right? It means you go through 30 boys, okay, and that you did that over, you know, 10, 15 years. So, but still finally, let's say just going through that, let's say after 10, 15 years, they do find Mr. Right. Let us say they're fortunate enough, they do find. Wouldn't it have been much nicer to just wait 10 years and avoid the other 10, you know, 20, 30 guys and just be with Mr. Right? You wouldn't have got your heart stomped on 20, 30 times. It would have been much nicer. That's knowing who you are. So if you want to say, yes, I'm willing to go out there with all my, you know, how you say, what would be the word, you know, where you kind of have an ideal and you think it's going to be nice and all that, you know, your idea of what, you know, love is going to be. You know, your ideology, like that. You know, like that. Of what it's going to be and then have it destroyed 20 or 30 times with all the, you know, I just say, you know, gross and uncultured boys that you catch because you're out there, you know, letting everybody see the merchandise. You know what I'm saying? You know, in the Vedic thing, the rule is, according to Manu, that a prostitute never shows her breasts. And if she shows her breasts, she drops her price by 50%. That's Manu. So that means nowadays they're dropped at least 50, if not, you know, some of them 75%. Right? So is that what the girl thinks she is? You know? No, she'll say I'm something different. then why doesn't she present herself as what she says she is? But she's worried the competition is too great, so therefore she's got to get out there and get in there before it's all lost. But the point is, the ones worth getting aren't out looking for something cheap. You know what I'm saying? So the point is the parent may not know who they are. That's fine. Okay, it may be. Your parents are at work all day, they never see you, they never put in the time. Maybe. But a good chance they do know more than you think they do. Right? But at the same time, is do they know themselves? And if they do, then why would you present yourself in a way that is not the way you want to live? If you want to live your life as a householder in a particular way, why wouldn't you present yourself that way? Then, because you're only looking for one guy, right? So basically there's about 3 billion guys on this planet, right? And so you only want to catch one of them. So why not act in a way that will catch that one guy, rather than act in a way that'll catch, you know, any of those, all 3 billion of them. You know what I'm saying? You know, it may be nice, but so what? You know, okay, you look good and everybody, but what's more important, being, you know, having all the guys as you walk down the street, you know, stare at you, but not do anything of any substance, right? It means they've gotten to see something, and they've gotten to be impressed by that, but what did they do for you to deserve that? You know what I'm saying? The girl is valuable, so she makes herself easily available. So what did the guy do to deserve that availableness? You know what I'm saying? You know, it's just like you take a car out there and put it on the say, and anybody can come and test drive it, but it should be only the ones that are actually have the ability to buy it. They should be the ones allowed to drive it. Right? Not just anybody who wants to come and take it for a spin. Right? So it's not really intelligent. Girls out there looking like that to catch a guy, but the point is she's throwing a net much broader than what she wants. So that's not very intelligent. That means she doesn't actually know who she is. She doesn't know what a woman is. She doesn't know that a woman's heart basically works really clean once. And once it's been broken once, it's broken. And then after that, you can kind of make do. And then at some point, it's just you know, pragmatic. You know, they have to have a guy so something's better than nothing. Right? Therefore, they just look through the pile of potatoes and which ones, you know, doesn't annoy them. You know, it's not, you know, too, got too many of those things sticking out, or too green, or too, you know, too rotten. You know, okay, I can do something with this potato. Okay, you know, there's a little corner over here. I could cut everything else away. Okay. Like that, then, you know, that's what you get. You know? So that's the point, is they're very proud, but they don't know what a woman is. That's why they hurt themselves. Because the point is if a relationship between a boy and a girl doesn't work, especially amongst teenagers, generally it's the girl who's going to hurt the most. For a lot of the boys, they're just out having a good time. So unless the girl's made an impression, then it may hurt the boy. Otherwise, hey, one night stands, or you know, a few nights ago for a few months, and then you break it off because you saw something better. You know, so you saw a double D rather than a C. You know, hey, you know, then no problem. You know what I'm saying? It's the girl who's going to hurt, because the girl needs to be connected to a boy. Technically, a boy who's attached should be connected to a girl, but technically a boy could be trained where he doesn't need to be connected to a girl. So if it doesn't work, he could, you know, be a brahmachari. The girls need to be married. So therefore, of the two, the girl's going to get hurt the most. Like that. And so, how many girls know that? So if they don't know that, it means they don't know who they are. They don't know what a heart of a girl is, even though they supposedly have one. You know? So they don't know what they're dealing with. That's why you see all these frustrated, you know, tough girls. It's not that that tough girl wasn't at one size time a nice, sweet little girl with all kinds of romantic ideas of what life would be. But after being stomped on so many times, you know, by, you know, guys with little mildew under their lip, then, you know, They lose it after a while. And then they don't think that such persons exist. So even if such a person does come along, they can't recognize. Even if you do have a boy who really cares and this and that, they don't think anybody cares, so therefore they can't even recognize. So they generally still end up with a more aggressive guise rather than someone who's actually going to be more sensitive and caring. Because it means once you become so dulled, then something in the mode of goodness doesn't actually, you don't notice it. So it's still just the guise and passion, ignorance, you know, look like something's going on. Because they don't believe that someone would actually care and take care of it. So you can try it. I'm saying to girls of today, go for it, you know, but it's only their heart that's going to get destroyed like that. You know, it's not the boys that's going to be less like that. You know? So since everybody's taking up more the masculine mood, the modern culture is geared more for the boys, even though the girls are trying to, you know, even the field and say it's equal with the girls, actually it's still more geared for the boys. Because one night stands don't bother a boy at all, they bother girls. Right? Girl's given herself, and then she hears, you know, in the hallways that, you know, the boy's talking about last night, you know, or the night before, you know, Saturday night, and yeah, easy, you know, this, that, you know. That's going to hurt. That's really going to hurt. Girl's given herself, and then she's just called easy. It's going to hurt. But that's what the boys are talking about. So they jumped it into the boys, go into the boys' world, but it's still the boys' world. Right? Equal doesn't mean you bring the men's into the girls' world. No. Activities they might try to, but it's not the mentality. The girls are trying to take on the boys' mentality. So they make it in the boys' world. So it's favorable to the boys, not to the girls. Like that. That's why Maya is so clever. You know, the liberated girls are actually subjecting themselves to the boys' world, which is even more exploitive and less favorable towards them. So then they suffer more. Does that make sense? So with that understanding, then the girl can decide whether she wants the parents to help or not. But the point is if she doesn't help herself, she's going to suffer. So if she doesn't know what she's talking about or what she's getting herself into or the methods to do it, then it's not going to work. It just can't.
Maharaj, again, though, you have mentioned sometimes this principle that in connection to material energy, that the more you are attached to something, it's more sure that you cannot get it. But if you are without attachment to something, then you can.
Yeah, that's a big problem for the living entity, because they want to control and enjoy it. But the more you can perform, the more you can interact with it appropriately, how it should be dealt with, without designing a result, then the more you'll get the result. That's just the way it's made, you know. So that's why Krishna recommends this. You want to have a nice, pleasant family life, so the only way to do it is by performing all the duties for it, but desiring no results. Then you'll get it. That's the point. The living entity will get all the pleasure that there is available, but only by it not being their pleasure. Right? When I'm only interested in Radha Krishna's pleasure, that's when I'm going to be happy. That's how we're designed. You know, that was the discussion the other day. You just accept that's the way we're built. Then things start to work. So your happiness is only going to be seeing other people happy. But the only way to actually make other people happy is knowing their nature and and performing the duties that go along with that, you know, that are appropriate for your and their nature being interactive. Right? That's the only way you'll be happy. As soon as you try to claim it yourself, it goes away. Right? Because the mind, Manamoy, is the platform of aparoksha. No, is it? Pratyaksha? Paroksha? Aparoksha, yeah, aparoksha. So aparoksha means the place of gaining understanding or knowledge where wherein your how you say, you are conscious of it, but at the same time you're not aware of it or focused on it. Like, and the example is given, the classic example is, you sleep at night, right? But you're completely dead to the world. But in the morning I can ask you how you slept and you can tell me. Right? But if you're aware of how you're sleeping, you're not sleeping, you're awake. Right? In the same way is, let us say something's going on. Let's say you're having, you know, if the kirtan's going and it's such a nice thing, but as soon as you stop and go, hey, this is a great kirtan, aren't we enjoying, you're no longer enjoying anymore. It's already left the present and moved into the past. So only at the present. So the present means you have to be experiencing it right now. As soon as you grasp that, then it moves into the past. It's ignorance. That's why the living entities are always in ignorance, because they're always trying to enjoy it. But it's only what's happening right now. So that you can only do when you're performing the duties without desiring result. Desiring result is passion, it's future. You know, and trying to be the enjoyer, you know, I mean, and then, you know, claiming that enjoyment, which is ignorance because it's not yours anyway, right, then puts it into the past. So you're no longer in the present. So that's why people in the mode of passion and ignorance never actually enjoy, because enjoyment's only in the present. That moment, that 1/11th of a second that's happening right now, that is where enjoyment is. So that can only be done through Naishkarmya. So that means you follow Naishkarmya, whatever you're looking for, you can get. But as soon as you claim it, you don't. It's not there anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like that. That's, you get used to that, that's how it is, then you see that it's nice. In other words, that's mode of goodness. Once you get used to it, then it's much nicer platform than passion or ignorance. But we have the idea of passion and ignorance, that defines Godhead. Right? I am the controller, it's ignorance. I am the enjoyer, passion. Right? But God, we always describe Him in connection to which mode? Right? So this perception of how we deal with it is the energy or the feminine view of what masculinity is. Right? It's just like if a woman's behaving like a man, she still is a woman. Right? So to other women who are tough, then, you know, they think they're pretty tough. But for men who know what men are and what women are, they're still women. So it's kind of amusing. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Regarding marriages again, Maharaj. This arranged marriages should there are so many things available for checking the compatibility, like this astrological thing.
So many things like that means it's the only one thing, right?
Yeah, astrology. Okay. No, another thing is parents go together. And
okay.
Talk.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
That's okay. So was this earlier followed in the Vedic culture that they check this astrology or the?
Yeah, it was always checked. It's recommended. Okay. Previous ages, it wouldn't be as important. Kali Yuga is more important, because of the mixing and stuff. But in previous ages it wasn't, because someone was in that line, it was a pure line, so what you see is what they are. There's nothing behind it, so there was... Plus they were so dutiful that even if the charts didn't match, it wouldn't matter, because they would perform their duties anyway, so the taste of grihastha life would be accomplished. It didn't matter like that, because the sense of duty and commitment was so great that despite being completely different personalities, it would still work. Right? Because in principle, there's certain things that a man is looking for in a woman, and a man. And if you perform the duties, those will be obtained. But your particular interests, are things that would naturally spark off interaction, that may not be there. But so through duties, they would create the interaction. You know, it would be more sober, but it would be deep. So by the astrological, you can tell if there's going to be more things there to spark interaction like that. Because in Kali Yuga, you can't always guarantee that duty is going to be always the basis of interaction. So that's why then it's recommended that the charts are looked at. Yeah?
Maharaj, you said that when we are doing our duties, then we are in the present without expecting any result. But as soon as we stop and say, I'm enjoying myself, it's already past. What about in devotional life? Because one
it's the same, but still it's connected to Krishna, so it's there, but it means that that experience you're getting now stops. Right? If you're discussing what a great kirtan is, you're not actually absorbed in the kirtan. You know what I'm saying? But because it's in connection with Krishna, therefore that experience still is there, and then from that it can be brought to the present, but still it's... I'm just giving that as an example. You know, like that.
So it applies more to material life?
It applies everywhere. But the point is, as long as we're conditioned, then it applies to us. In the spiritual world, then they can think about how they were with Krishna earlier in the day or the night before. And because the thinking of Krishna, that thought of Krishna brings it to the present. But because there's no time, then it is present. Well, in the material world, the thing is in the past. We can talk about it now so it brings it to the present, so it brings some element of present into it. So we can still kind of taste it and get something, but it is past. There is a difference. That's why it won't give the same as what's happening right now. You know, you can talk about a relationship that was there, and depending on how much you talk about it and to what detail, to that much you can get an experience from it. But you can only do that so many times, and then because it is past. But Krishna is always present, so even if you did something with him before, if you talk about it now, then whatever is done with Krishna is eternal. Right? The activity is eternal, the experience is eternal. So discussing it or thinking about it, it's actually eternal. So it's present, it's always present. So it's non-different. So if it's devotional activities, directly it's non-different. But anything else other than that, then will be affected by, you know, past, present, and future.
But mentally meditating on Krishna also brings us to the present.
Yeah, because Krishna is present. Mm-hmm. You know, he is existence, so he is present. You know, he is means the how you say, the present tense is Krishna. You know, the moment is Krishna. That's why the moment works. That's where you get your experiences, never, because it is Krishna. That's where everything's happening. Whatever you want, whatever, and everything, it's all happening in the present. That doesn't mean that we only worry about the present, no. We know the philosophy, we have the lifestyle, we make plans on how things will work, we learn from the past, but experience is only happening in the present. You know what I'm saying? So only the Vedas can give us that. The modern will say, be here now, be the present, but then they only deal with the present. They don't understand how to deal with future and past. So they can't bring that into the equation. So that's why it works in one way, but not in another. It basically just creates hedonism. Right? But the Vedic, it doesn't, because you're dealing in the present on duties without desire for a result, so therefore it's not hedonism. And past activities that are done in the present, you meditate on those to see what is to be learned from it, not trying to enjoy them, but what to learn from them, what was important from them. And then behaving in such a way that it will, you know, whatever is, you know, the future of your duties, that you are working in such a way that you don't compromise those. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's say you're planning to get married, so therefore now I'm doing as a proper brahmachari, and that's my inspiration to, you know, be brahmachari, because I will get married, so I can only be a good grihastha if I'm a good brahmachari, therefore now I'm trying to be a good brahmachari. So the fact that you're living in the present, you know, so you may be dealing in the present because of some future plan, but you're dealing in the present, you're not living in the future. You know what I'm saying? Or you're dealing with the past, but you're not living in the past. So that's the whole point. The Vedic is you deal with future and I mean future and past in the present. You don't live in them. You live in the present. That would be the difference.
Yes, but does history and the past have any importance for us?
Things to learn. That's what you mean by something to learn. Somebody did something, it got a good result, then that's good. Someone did something, got a bad result, then that's not so good. Right?
Couldn't we say also that my present is based on my past?
It is, but still you have to live in the present. If you're always thinking about, oh, we had that, and we were there, and then we lost all that, then you're not living in the present. Mm-hmm. Even though you're discussing that at present, you're not living there. Right? But the point is right now I have to deal with the situation. So those in the past dealt with this situation in this way, and they got a good result, so I should follow that method. But there's some who dealt like that in the past, and it didn't work for them. So I should avoid that. Does that make sense?
Yes. But what I am today, for example, if somebody say, what I am today is based on my past.
Yeah, but you still have to deal with your past at the present. If you deal with your past as the past, then it's not going to work. You know what I'm saying? Let us say, the ornament is made out of gold ore. But do you deal with the gold, the ornament like gold ore, or you deal with it like an ornament? Yeah, because gold ore, you can pick it up, throw it on the ground, kick it around, you know, play baseball with it, do whatever you want, nothing happens. But can you do that with your ornament? No. The ornament is an ornament. It was that, but it is this now. You know, it is a gold ornament because it was gold ore. Yes, if it had been silver ore, it'd be a silver ornament. But that doesn't mean you live in the past, you live in the present. Right? Because that will also create confidence. You live in the past, it creates lack of confidence because you and the past actually are separated. It's gone. So that's why people who live in the past, they're always, how you say, when you're not confident?
Insecure.
Like that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Another question about this committing offenses against Vaishnavas. Now, if you are really hurt by a Vaishnava, and there is another place, of course it is, we know that we should not commit offenses, but if you are really hurt, of course it's not a spiritual, some material reason or something like that. Then, and in another place it is said that you should tell what is in your heart. So how do you deal with these two things?
Okay. I think Vashishta, he says the most prominent quality of a Brahmin is forgiveness. Yeah? Okay. Speaking what's in your heart, then is there only one way to say it? No, it means look at it realistically. Right? Let us say what's in your heart is down at work there's something wrong and the boss really doesn't know what they're talking about. Okay. How are you going to express that to your other colleagues? Right? What if you express that to the boss himself? You're going to say it the same way? No. So that means there's a variety of ways in which you can say the same thing. So the point is revealing what's in your heart or saying what's in your heart or being true to yourself doesn't mean you have to be rough and gross and insulting to others, because then that's, why is that truth? You know what I'm saying? If you say, I'm upset, that's truth. You don't have to show that grossly, you know what I'm saying? And always remember, Brahman's primary quality is forgiveness. So based on that, how are you going to speak the truth? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Anything else? No? Okay, so Gantaram Srimad Bhagavatam ki?
Jai!
Prabhupada ki?
Jai!
Samadeta Bhaktivrinda ki?
Jai!
His Holiness Bhaktivedya Purna Swami Maharaj ki?
Jai!
Sadhu!
Sadhu!